Here comes Uncle Don's Porcupine Petting Zoo number 288. The home station is CFUR at 88.7 FM and rebroadcast on CHLS in Lillooet and CJLY in Nelson, Kootenai Lake. I'm back from a six-day whirlwind solo tour of our huge province. One night with friends in Lillooet and then two nights with another old friend in Victoria before stays in motels in Princeton and Vernon and breaking for home. Too much driving in too little time. I wouldn't try that once again. I'm too old for that kind of marathon. It was great to visit Ian and Vivian in Lillooet. Busy as they are with their jobs and extensive volunteer work, they always have a few hours for gracious hospitality and a place to crash. A high point of that stop was meeting two of the volunteers and visiting the studio of CHLS. The station has two spacious rooms in the Lillooet Community Center with windows overlooking the swimming pool. Hello to all of those listeners in Lillooet who are subjected to my weekly rants. I made a strategic error by arriving in Nelson on Sunday morning, when the town is dead and staff absent from the studio of CJLY. There were only two men there, one on the air and the other quite busy, so I looked the place over, left my card, and hit the road. Kootenai Co-op Radio has obtained a small house, on which they've done enormous renovations. I was again impressed by the well of vibrant spirit in Nelson. Is one of the communities that my wife and I are considering for relocation when the day comes that we're unable to keep up the property we own. Now, if the community activists would just level out all those hills. At motels in Princeton and Vernon, eyebrows were raised when I admitted that I live in Prince George. I reassured nervous clerks that I'm a non-combatant and did not bear arms. We have quite a reputation to live down in this town. Before I launch into my usual negative rant, I want to get the positive stuff out of the way. During my 6 days on the road, I ran across not a single miserable person. Everyone was unfailingly pleasant and helpful. With the exception of a very few impatient folk and a handful of speeders, fellow drivers were courteous and patient. The only downside to the entire trip was my own fault in trying to drive too far each day. Around this time each year, I have occasion to dedicate a show to my gun-toting fellow citizens. I'm referring not to gangs of hoodlums giving our community the reputation of a free fire zone, akin to downtown Kandahar. That's a different problem. I mean those macho dudes who cruise our rural roads equipped with thousands of dollars worth of high-end 4x4 pickup trucks, bearing all-terrain vehicles and beer, while carrying fancy rifles and dressed in designer camouflage. The purpose of these men, invariably men, is to kill a moose, a hunt rationalized by an inability to afford beef, and to engage in sport. Yes, it's a real challenge to kill an unarmed animal while alcoholically impaired. Now, there are those who need wild meat for subsistence, like First Nations people or rural folk who live on the economic edge. With them, I have no quarrel, as they are generally responsible. What gets my goat is the wealthy intruders in our woods who have no respect for the area nor its wildlife. Their traces can be found along our gravel road. Every day I walk my dogs on this road, bearing a plastic bag to pick up their beer cans, cigarette packs, and assorted debris that they don't want cluttering their fancy vehicles. I return from my drive around the province to find that the end of our road has again been used as a garbage dump by our mighty sportsmen. Among the detritus is a moose head, pelt, and offal in large plastic pails. A hearty thank you to those slobs who feel that our area is fine to visit, to hunt in, and for dumping their garbage. On this anniversary of the Spring Hill mining disaster, I learned that survivors of that tragedy were invited to enjoy a free vacation courtesy of the state of Georgia. Those taking advantage of this offer discovered a fact of life in the U.S. South, legal segregation. Some miners of Nova Scotia were of mixed race, as interpreted by Georgian law. Black survivors were forced to take their offered holiday separately from their fellow miners, which must have been a shock to men whose jobs formed for strong feelings of solidarity. My introduction to racial segregation came one morning in February of 1959. As a newly sworn soldier, I joined a flock of recruits traveling from Pennsylvania to South Carolina by train. We pulled into the station in Columbia early in the morning. I looked out my window to see the platform with doors marked, "White Men, White Women, Colored Men, and Colored Women." There were separate drinking fountains so that the good white folk would not be contaminated by their lessers. Fort Jackson was an island of integration in a sea of mandated separation. President Truman had ordered the end of segregation in the military some 12 years earlier. Still, it seemed odd that most officers were white, and infantrymen were predominantly black. Local recruits were shocked upon being introduced to their new digs in Company D, 8th Battalion, 2nd Training Regiment. Bunks were assigned alphabetically, and good old Southern boy hillbillies were forced to mingle, even sleep, in the presence of those they had considered their genetic inferiors. Black power had not yet come into fashion, so the blacks in our company were mostly subservient by habit. Habit, I'm sure, disappeared after training and integration into working units. The black man in the bunk below me was named Lewis. I'll never forget that in those 9 weeks in which we shared this arrangement, I could not break him of the habit of calling me sir. It was creepy. After basic training, I was sent to school in Aberdeen Proving Grounds in Maryland, still below the Mason-Dixon line. One weekend, I went to town to buy a bus ticket, forgetting that soldiers in uniform paid half price. I was wearing civilian clothes, so I asked a uniformed soldier to buy my ticket. After he did this, I offered to buy him a Coke. We went into a hole-in-the-wall cafe, and I ordered two Cokes. The white clerk said, "That's one Coke and one to go." "No, we'll drink 'em here," I said. "No, that's one Coke and one to go," she iterated. My new friend, who was decidedly black, rapidly backed off, and I was momentarily confused until I realized the problem. Although this other soldier was good enough to go into battle to protect that clerk's precious ass, he was not good enough to drink a soft drink in her establishment. I don't honestly remember what I said to that woman, but I was somewhat short of polite. I've done a slow boil ever since when I think of that incident. I can't think of a better person to quote than John Maynard Keynes in these days when Milton Friedman's ideas have been discredited. Here are Keynes' comments about inflation. Quote, "Lenin is said to have declared that the best way to destroy the capitalist system was to debauch the currency. By a continuing process of inflation, governments can confiscate, secretly and unobserved, an important part of the wealth of their citizens. Lenin was certainly right." Close quote. Are governments of the world unknowingly destroying the system they are intent upon saving when they flood the markets with liquidity? That's money, and excess money is the root and symptom of inflation. When phantom money in the trillions of dollars is dumped into circulation, this begs for runaway inflation. Perhaps politicians are making a pact with the devil, exchanging a depreciation of our money for salvage of some form of control over markets. There is a more sinister possible explanation. This may be one of those shocks the public, as predicted by Naomi Klein. When people lose confidence in the currencies of the world, they may cry for a leader and a system that restores stability at any cost. It worked for Hitler. Fascism and fascist are words thrown about with abandon by those seeking to demonize political opponents. But what is fascism? Over the years, a number of fascist governments have existed within a broad spectrum of policies and methods. Foremost in the origin of the label was Mussolini's Italian regime. Hitler's Germany and Tojo's Japan were also classed as fascist, as have been a number of South American dictatorships, most notably Chile's Pinochet. A dictionary definition of fascism emphasizes that a fascist government is one run by a dictator with complete power. It suppresses opposition and criticism while regimenting capitalist commerce and exhibiting an aggressive nationalism. This definition covers a whole range of variables, but is usually compared with democracy. But the two can be compatible. I think of fascism as a form of government in which a powerful leader serves the interests of private capital and an elite class to the detriment of workers and other average citizens. This leader need not be one who has seized power. He or she can be elected, as was Hitler initially. The nation can have a constitution and a form of elected representation as long as the laws can be ignored and those elected follow their leader's orders. A critical element of fascism is that the wealthy rule, although it may be through a powerful front of lessers. Decisions of the great leader are calculated to aid the rich in their businesses while suppressing popular aspirations. Unions are weakened, if not crushed. Other centers of potential challenge are eliminated or co-opted. Organized religions and some of these centers which may be harnessed. Fascist governments are often racist, but not necessarily, if other than racial scapegoats can be conjured. Opposition may be left as a rump, which can be vilified and ridiculed, a convenient target to be blamed for failures. Where is Canada on the continuum between pure democracy and fascism? I think we're closer to the latter than the former. We have a minority government elected with about 22% of eligible voters, which has, under our system, near dictatorial powers. We're very fortunate that the ideologues of Harper's misnamed conservatives failed to achieve their hoped-for majority in this past election. I was not alone in fearing that Harper, with a parliamentary majority, would ram through changes leading our country to become unrecognizable. Even with his past minority, he was able to shrink tax obligations of corporations in the wealthy class while eliminating regulatory controls. Lower tax revenues have hobbled government services. Lack of regulation has literally killed citizens. Witness poisonings by Maple Leaf Foods and Harvey's fast food joints. Harper followed his mentor, the Big W, in removing controls designed to prevent an economic collapse of the sort the world sees now. He no longer can be heard referring to Canada as an energy superpower, as falling oil prices cause reconsideration of planned tar sands developments in spite of overly generous tax rates, minuscule royalties, unenforced environmental regulation, and subsidies. Our electoral system has become a playground for right-wing media, attack advertising, extravagant promises, and plain simple lies. Lurking in the background is a carefully cultivated fear driving our citizens to accept participation in an aggressive war in support of a discredited leader of a nation in more trouble than Canada. Canada's not a fascist nation, but take a look at the way the wind is blowing and decide where we may be heading. The Vancouver Olympic Organizing Committee has been big in our news lately. First, there was the exclusion of a charity supporting the disabled because one of their sponsors was Maserati and one of the Olympic sponsors, a very jealous entity, is General Motors. Or perhaps GM was a sponsor. This corporation has been placed on a credit watch and its debts had fallen to junk status. Its stocks sell for a price not seen since I was young. I suppose GM stock is one of those great buying opportunities Stephen Harper referred to before his election. In any case, money pledged by General Motors may not be forthcoming unless the market for oversized vehicles increases dramatically. Loss of GM sponsorship could leave a huge hole in their finances, which the British Columbia taxpayer may have to fill. Then there's the cost of security for the Olympics, arbitrarily budgeted at $175 million. Experts now suggest costs may actually run to as much as $1 billion with all the cops, soldiers, and high-tech junk they plan to employ. More for the taxpayer to pick up when the smoke clears. And we have the Athletes' Village, the construction of which is facing huge cost overruns. Will our provincial Liberal government allow that to stop construction? Hell no. Throw more tax dollars at it. And by the way, when the 2009 provincial election comes around, just pledge more tax cuts. On the 8th of July, 2003, George Bush was in Dakar, Senegal. On that visit, loquacious George made the following remarkable statement, quote, "It's very interesting when you think about it. The slaves who left here to go to America, because of their steadfast and their religion and their belief in freedom, helped change America," unquote. I have in my over-fertile imagination a picture of those freedom-loving Africans preparing to depart for America. "Come along, folks, we gotta hurry if we're not gonna miss the ship for the New World. Leave the luggage. From here on, all your needs will be provided by your friendly tour guides. Accommodation will be rudimentary, but there are enough chains for all. When you get to the promised land, survivors will soon forget their old families and villages. Entertainment and employment will be assured, and your new employers will see that you apply 110% to your tasks. Just be patient, and one of your great-great-great-grandsons may have a chance to become president of this fine land to which you are being removed. Of course, he will not be black like you, but diluted somewhat by horny white ancestors. No matter, white folks will call him black." Although we're used to that resident of the White House, soon to join hundreds of thousands of his countrymen in being evicted, making ridiculous statements, I can hardly put myself in the sandals of those Africans listening to him this time. Just think, slaves, because of their steadfast and their religion and their belief in freedom, helped change America. Yeah, they sweated, bled, and died by the millions to build a nation for their owners, all the while being steadfast, faithful, and believing in the freedom beyond their grasp. My God, what an idiot that George Bush is. Isn't it comforting that Stephen Harper has pledged to stay the course in Afghanistan? He assures us that everything will be patched up by 2011, with the local army strong enough to maintain security for the government and the Afghan police force purged of corrupt officers. Our combat troops will then return to Canada, their outgoing path strewn with flowers, probably poppies, as they march into the Afghan sunset. Those officers will return home on schedule, Steve promised. As to the present, their democratically elected government has a newfound respect for the rule of law and human rights under their new constitution. Well, there are a few flaws in that constitution, like the part mandating the death penalty for blasphemy. Under this law, a 23-year-old Afghan student was condemned to die for questioning Islam's treatment of women. This sentence was graciously reduced, after pressure from occupying powers, to imprisonment for a mere 20 years. He's unlikely to survive the first year of that sentence within their brutal system administered by fanatical fundamentalists. This is the government which Canada supports. This is the government for which we send our soldiers to die. This is the government for which we send our soldiers to kill. We can be proud. Desperate supporters of McCain and his pathetic campaign partner have pulled all stops in the attempt to woo the undecided in next week's election. They've taken to emphasizing Obama's middle name, Hussein, and a whisper rumor campaign rumors that he is a closet Muslim. Colin Powell, a man betrayed and set up by the Big W as his front man promoting lies about Iraqi weapons of mass destruction, has refuted this prevarication. Barack Obama is now, and always has been, a faithful Christian. Obama does not follow the strange customs and odd beliefs of Islam. Obama follows the strange customs and odd beliefs of Christianity. It is sad that the world's superpower, no one can be elected dog catcher without declaring fealty to one religion or another. It will be a proud day when a person can stand for high office in the United States, or Canada, while declaring that he or she is neither religious nor superstitious, that he or she bases their life and politics on rationality and science, that this universe and life itself are the result of natural, physical processes without the oversight of an omnipotent being, that they have a decent respect for life as a one-time chance to experience the joys and challenges of this planet without a hollow promise of an afterlife. On that fine day, nations of the world might be able to deal with each other on the basis of cooperation rather than conflict. But I'm not holding my breath. This is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. Have we had one of the shocks described by Naomi Klein in her recent book, The Shock Doctrine? She made the case that those seeking to make vast, unpopular changes to their societies will take advantage of or fabricate crises causing chaos and raising popular fear. We are immersed in a huge worldwide economic meltdown, making people fear for their jobs, their homes, their pensions, and their very value of their money. It's a matter of conjecture whether these masters of the universe of Wall Street, Bay Street, and our banks knew that they were laying the foundation for disaster when they extended impossible credit and walked away with their millions and billions in profits. Was there an agenda for collapse hidden in those ubiquitous think tanks full of Friedman's disciples? What changes will politicians put over on society while people are distracted? The vast transfer of public money and credit from government to private banks and corporations is unprecedented. Our governments had even put the job of writing credit markets into the hands of those self-same geniuses who got us into this mess. For this, they will be handsomely rewarded yet again. When oil was soaring to $147 a barrel, people you may have heard of, like John McCain and Sarah Palin, were promoting drilling in pristine environments like the Arctic National Wildlife Reserve and North America's rich coastal waters, which wiser folks had set aside for preservation. Now that oil prices have halved and the pressure of scarcity is relieved, what's the reaction of our leaders? A greater push for drilling in wilderness and offshore. The need has decreased, but it seems possible that the Canadian government, under the wise guidance of Canada's self-confessed smartest man, will lift the three-decade-long federal moratorium on ocean drilling. This is being pushed by British Columbia's smartest man, Gordon Campbell, as an antidote to economic stagnation. In this quest, he's been joined by Dan Miller, former NDP premier. The public is distracted, and almost anything can happen. One thing is sure. Drilling in British Columbia's offshore, with its turbulent weather and rough seas, will be the scene of disastrous oil spills or blowouts. The BC Oil and Gas Commission has reported 6 pipeline incidents in the last 3 years involving releases of sulfur dioxide alone. If these incidents can happen on land, what can we expect offshore? The consequences could well make the Exxon Valdez spill look like an oil slick in the gutter. But the oil companies will make their billions, and the public will be stuck with the cleanups. Meanwhile, that oil, which we have been told is so necessary for our country, will join our natural gas in being exported. What are those milk solids listed on labels of quasi-food products in our grocery shelves? I have no idea, but it sounds creepy. Could it be that milk solids are to milk, as military justice is to justice? One thing we know for sure, milk solids are cheaper for manufacturers than real milk. If they weren't, Kraft Canada, Parmalat Canada, and Saputo Incorporated would not be in court challenging new federal regulations requiring the use of more full-fat milk in their production of cheese. As I said, I don't know what chemical monstrosity hides behind the label milk solids, but I know that store cheese doesn't taste or feel like the product we used to buy. I welcome the new regulation and wish that governments would do more to require real, non-factory ingredients in our foods. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development produced a study of relative incomes in 30 developed nations. Not surprisingly, this 20-year investigation revealed that the gap between the rich and the poor has widened in every one of these countries. The United States has seen the greatest growth of disparity. While richest households have enjoyed steady increases in wealth, the middle and lower classes have stagnated. Canada is one of those countries in which middle-income earners have been left behind. Did it ever make you wonder how this can happen in any country if democracy really is working? As I've grown older, my hair, such as remains, is closer to my heels. In fact, I measure a full 2 centimeters shorter than I did in my 20s. If I had not been trained in economics, I would say that I have shrunk. But economists do not recognize shrinkage. They speak only of negative growth. Negative growth, what an odd concept. It makes me think of a tree retreating into a seed or a chicken returning to its egg. Why do people in this allegedly scientific trade refuse to recognize that an economy, like an aging man, can shrink? It is characteristic of any group, whether a trade or secretive order, seeking to make its circle seem important and wise, that it will adopt arcane codes, handshakes, and/or vocabulary. The trade of economics is in disrepute these days, as all of their graphs, formulas, and predictions prove to be worth less than a bucket of warm spit. If economists relearned the English language, they would be revealed to have feet of clay, so don't hold your breath on that one either. My heart bleeds for members of our society suffering from the decline in our dollar relative to the American one. Take, for instance, those owners of occupational hockey companies allegedly representing Canadian cities. Not that these players come from those cities, nor even from Canada. They sign contracts for outrageous salaries and play children's games, signifying nothing for the entertainment of the masses. Now, those owners of Canadian teams are hurting as they pay inflated salaries in Yankee dollars. I wonder why it is legal for an employer in Canada to pay salaries in a foreign currency. If one works here and supposedly lives here, he or she should be compensated in our national money. I won't even venture into the question as to why a sports team, supposedly a cooperative enterprise, has an owner at all. Have these players, who are not born Canadian, actually gone through the formalities of immigration? I came here to work productively and submitted myself to 5 months of bureaucratic procedures before being found fit for immigration. If a man can be fast-tracked through the process when coming to play children's games, what message does that send to those with useful skills who seek to come to Canada? We have untold thousands of hopeful people waiting in queues for landed immigrant status, while some with dubious skills and or buckets of money march to the head of the line. Tain't right. I saw a slogan the other day that gave me pause. It was, "Service worth waiting for." Think about it. As a mind twister, it rivals the sign once seen at a local gas emporium reading, "Friendly self-service." No kidding. And there is a restaurant in Port Alberni boasting Chinese fast food. Their name, verdinkum, is Wait You. Gordon Campbell's been a disaster for our province, and if he had not been lucky, he would have been a disaster for someone on Hawaii's roads when he drove drunk, but never mind. One positive thing Campbell has done was the introduction of a minuscule carbon tax on fuel. In my estimation, it should have been a lot higher, and supplemented by punishing taxes on oligopolistic oil corporations and speculators which have inflicted their own private taxes on drivers. While other jurisdictions are playing with cap-and-trade schemes, a direct visible tax is the most effective way to curb energy use, period. The tax brings in revenue to government, which could be used wisely to promote conservation. That's another issue. Cap-and-trade will give license to polluters while establishing yet another set of financial markets for speculators. It will rely on dubious measurements of emissions subject to manipulation and will also require more bureaucrats to administer the trades. It's disappointing that Carol James, head of the provincial NDP, has chosen the carbon tax as a specific target when Campbell has been responsible for so many other policies that have been a disaster. Think privatization of BC Rail and major functions of BC Hydro. Think his drastic cuts to income taxes for those who can most afford to pay. Think the huge increases in salaries to legislators and top bureaucrats. And all James can come up with is axe the tax. Very musical, but very dumb. Campbell has a plan to save British Columbia from economic chaos. Since most of his plan is smoke, he's creating more pollution. He increased government insurance for credit union accounts from $100,000 to infinity. This pleases those with hundreds of thousands to harbor in GICs, but does little more for the public than increase exposure in case of a credit union failure. He accelerated introduction of income tax cuts promised for later, thus decreasing revenue at a time when commodity income is falling precipitously. And he swears that the province will not endure a budget deficit. Uh-oh, here come more drastic cuts to services or sale of more public property. He will accelerate spending on infrastructure, which is fine, but where will the money come from? Here we go with more PPP projects, the triple P standing for pilfering the public purse. This offloads costs to future generations, but no matter. Jesus is coming to iron everything out. Campbell is recalling the legislature for a fall sitting. And what right had he to suspend that scheduled sitting in the first place? Now, he says, the financial crisis requires new legislation to cope with it. I suppose there were no other issues demanding the attention of our overpaid legislators, like overruns in Olympic spending, which will keep the public will have to backstop, like growing poverty and homelessness. The list goes on, but you get the point. We've all heard the Chinese curse, may you live in interesting times. Well, here we are. If the Chinese were not involved, they would be smiling. This has been the 288th opening of Uncle Don's Porcupine Petting Zoo on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. Rebroadcasts can be heard on CJLY in Nelson Kootenai Lake and CHLS in Lillooet. Now rush down and put your millions in a credit union, safe in the knowledge that they're backed up with the full faith and credit of the province of British Columbia. Uh-oh.